See a little book there? That is one of the great books of the Western world. In fact, when the University of Chicago did their great books of the Western civilization, one of the books chosen was the Pensées and the Provincial Letters of Blaise Pascal. It's in modern library, it's in every man library, it's practically every different, you can get a French copy, you can get probably every language of the world, the Pensées, the thoughts of Blaise Pascal. And I'm going to get to tell you about him tonight and do some readings from this. It's a wonderful book to put on an airplane with you or on a train or even the metro, because it's made up of all these little thoughts that are numbered. You just never tire of it. There's something about it you'll see. In fact, I like to carve inscriptions of heroes of mine, C.S. Lewis inscriptions and G.K. Chesterton inscriptions and George MacDonald ones, on driftwood. I'll do it again this summer. I do it now by commission. My kids actually say, will you carve something for us? I do it. It's not that good, but I just take driftwood and carve. And I've carved a number of great Pascal quotations on pieces of driftwood, because that's how quotable he is. My biggest one I have in my head in my office, and that is, do great things as though they were small because of Jesus Christ. Do small things as though they were great because of Jesus Christ. That's one of my favorite Pascals. I have that on a huge, long log. So anyway, he's noted for those one-liners that are just totally marvelous. But I want to tell you about this man tonight. Blaise Pascal was born near Paris, 1623. His mother died when he was 3 years old. And he was raised by his father, Stephen Pascal, along with his younger and older sisters. He had a younger sister named Jacqueline, who plays a very big part in Pascal's life, and an older sister named Gilbray. Gilbray gets married later and takes care of Pascal toward the end of his life. His father raised these three children and educated them himself. I guess they were homeschooled, you'd have to say, by this very, very brilliant scientific father. The interesting quirk on that is that he realized this young son was coming along and was totally fascinated with mathematics. And that, by the way, any list of the five most brilliant human beings in the world, Pascal would usually be in that list of five most brilliant, because you usually tell brilliance by child prodigy. That's why you have to put Mozart on that list and Beethoven on that list, Bach, because of their child prodigy, or Mendelssohn. But for sure, Pascal. Because Pascal, on his own, because his father was a little worried that he was getting too interested in mathematics, so his father tried to shield him from mathematics. So he wants him to learn the liberal arts and everything. Most parents would go just the other way. And so this boy figured out the Pythagorean theorem himself without his dad's help. By age 11, he had written a full paper on physics of liquids and physics of... He later got a physics law of fluids that was named after Pascal. So his father's attempt to shield him for mathematics did not work. So at 16, he's written this paper on conic sections from geometry. And at 19, he's recognized as a genius in Paris. And so his father then gives up for sure on trying to control the boy as a mathematician. He is a mathematician and physicist now. By 19, totally recognized as a genius. At 19, a major accident occurs. After that accident, Pascal calls this his first conversion. A Roman Catholic priest who was very kind to him and very helpful to him, he made his first profession of faith and became a Christian at age 19. Then, at age 24, he had a stroke, a major stroke. Left him paralyzed for a while, one side. And then he's cared for by his father and his sister, Jacqueline, and other sister. Well, his other sister now gets married. So it's just Jacqueline, his younger sister, who he's very, very devoted to, and his father. Then his father dies in 1651. And so now Jacqueline, at that point, decides to enter a convent, the famous convent of Port Royal. And it's a very interesting convent, because head of the convent is a priest who is a follower of Cornelius Jansen. Cornelius Jansen was an Augustinian, and a huge debate began to rage around that abbey with regard to another group of Roman Catholic leaders, which were the Jesuits. And so there was a huge, you might say, theological warfare that occurred between the what was called the Jansenists, who were at Port Royal Abbey, where Jacqueline was. And now Pascal is very devoted to Jacqueline, and he's spending a great deal of time at that convent himself. And so he becomes very attached to it and very much in favor of that tremendous group of people that were there, these Christians who were Augustinian. And so the debate began to rage with the Jesuits over the special doctrine of grace that the Jansenists were teaching, which was Augustinian, and the Jesuits were more in the St. Thomas Aquinas school. We would look at this and say some of these points are rather minor points, and it was later decided by the Vatican. There was threats for a while that there would be excommunication of these folks, but it wasn't. They were finally accepted. So the debate finally ended. But it caused this furious debate. And during that time, Pascal, who is now very devoted to his sister, Jacqueline, who's now a nun in this abbey, and also to all the other priests there, especially one of the priests in that monastery who he becomes very fond of, Father Arnould. And so Father Arnould is under attack by the Jesuits. So Pascal decides to write some letters. Now, I'm telling you all this because it's kind of humorous. He writes fictitious letters. He creates a name, Louis de Montale. And Louis de Montale writes a group of letters, fictional letters, and he does it over a 10-year period from 1656 to 1657. Not 10 years, over 1 year, but he writes 19 letters over that 1 year period. And the letters are called the provincial letters. So when you buy the Pensées, you get the Pensées at the beginning, and you get the provincial letters at the end. And the provincial letters create a stir, a tremendous stir in Paris and in France. Voltaire, who's an atheist, was totally captivated by the provincial letters. And no one knew who Louis de Montale was until after the death of Pascal. And then they realized it was Pascal who wrote all these hilarious, humorous letters. But they were also very theologically responsible letters to defend Father Arnould against these Jesuit attackers. It's just wonderful. The letters are absolutely priceless. In fact, I'm going to do a reading from one of the letters to show you the wit of Pascal. Now, I have to tell you a funny story. When I became a Christian as a young sophomore at the University of California, Berkeley, through a Bible study group, I was really a raw recruit coming into Christian faith, for sure. And I had read nothing, really. I had read no Christian books to get me primed or ready for my Bible study. I just simply got into a Bible study group, and then I became a believer. And the first two books that I read, other than the Bible, were The Pensées by Pascal and The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. And the irony of it is they're both, have a large part of them, have fictional letters. Written fictionally, and of course the Screwtape Letters from a senior devil to a junior devil, and then these wonderful letters that Pascal wrote. And so he imagined he was able to pull this off, and no one suspected that it was this man who by now was famous as a physicist. He has all these, he has physics law named after him. He's considered the father of the computer because he actually, through probability theory, actually was able to posit the possibility of a computer that could be done with just two switches, on and off, on and off. And that is the basis of all computers. And so he gets credit for that. He is just this incredible genius already being recognized. But no one would ever suspect this mathematician, rather sickly, because he's being cared for, has to be cared for. He died at 39, you know. That's the sadness about the life of this great man. That this man is this outlandish correspondent. The provincial letters were translated into all kinds of languages. As I said, Voltaire called them the most brilliant things he had seen in French at the time, though it didn't convert him to Christianity, but it impressed him. So I'm just, for the fun of it, before I read you some of the Pensées, because after the provincial letters were over, then he basically zeroed in on writing his thoughts to try to make the case for Christianity. And he collected thoughts, and he wrote them, and he had a few general headings. I'm going to show them to you in a minute. A few general headings, and then he died. And his sister, Jacqueline died just before he died. And then his older sister, she put them together. Jacqueline had begun to put them together too. And then after his death, they were assembled, put together under the title, The Pensées, The Thoughts of this man, Pascal. Okay. But the provincial letters deserve a chance to be heard. And so I'm going to read just one of the funny provincial letters that you'll get a kick out of. Now, I realize these are rather obscure points of theology that he's debating, but he does it with such wit that you'll get a big kick out of it, I think. He's having, in these fictional debates, this man, Luis, is having a talk with this priest, who is, of course, a Jesuit, and is trying to make the case for his doctrine of grace over against the Augustinian. By the way, the Augustinian doctrine of grace is more Protestant. And when we think of, Calvin and Luther look back to Augustine, not to St. Thomas Aquinas as much. They look back to Augustine, so that makes it a little more on the Protestant side. But anyway, he's making a big case, and so he's telling about the dialogue he has with his father, Bounty. Father Bounty says, would you have a more authentic witness to this point? He says, here is a book by Father Anat. In the last, he's the one who wrote against Professor Arnould. See who that's the attack against. He says, turn to page 34. You'll see a dog's ear there. And read the lines that I have marked with pencil. They ought to be written in letters of gold. I then read these words. He that hath no thought of God, nor of his sins, nor any apprehension, that is, that he explained it, any knowledge of his obligation to exercise the acts of love to God or contrition, has therefore no actual grace for exercising those acts, but equally he has no guilt for sin. And this is the big debate. Are you guilty for sins if you didn't know about them? And the Augustinian said, no, you're guilty for sins all the way along, so you have to have total help for total need. That's a great Bart line, but that's St. Augustine. But the Jesuits were saying, oh no, if you don't know about the sin, then it isn't really sin. You haven't really committed sin if you didn't know about it. So that's the debate that's being carried on in these letters. So if you don't know it, you don't have grace. Until you have grace, you can't even know about your sins, and so you wouldn't know you sinned. So he says, I exclaimed, I'm delighted. What a charming train of consequences do I discover flowing from this doctrine. I can see the whole results already. And such mysteries present themselves before me. Why, I see more people beyond all comparison justified by this ignorance and forgetfulness of God. It's almost like Bonhoeffer's cheap grace, you know. If I don't know about it, then I'm not guilty of it. It's a general truth. But my dear father, are you not inspiring me with a delusive joy? Are you sure there is nothing here like that sufficiency which suffices not? I am terribly afraid of that. I was taken with that once already. Are you quite earnest? How now? Cried the monk, beginning to get angry. I'm no matter of jesting. I assure you there's no such thing as an equivocation here. And so he says, okay, now I'm glad to know that. So I perceive. Now listen to Pascal. I'm going to read now this rather beautiful little funny satirical part. So I perceive, said I to him aside, and then turning to the monk. Oh, my dear sir, cried I, what a blessing this will be to some persons of my acquaintance. I must positively introduce them to you. You have never, perhaps, met with people who had fewer sins to account for all of your life. For in the first place, they never think of God at all. So therefore, you see, they're not guilty of any sins. Their vices have got the better of their reason. They have never known either their weakness or the physician who can cure it. They have never thought of desiring the health of their soul, and still less of praying to God to bestow it. So that, according to you, they are still in a state of baptismal innocence. They have never had a thought of loving God or of being contrite for their sins. So that, according to Father Anat, then they have never committed sin through the want of charity or penitence. Their life is spent in a perpetual round of all sorts of pleasures, in the course of which they have not been interrupted by the slightest remorse. These excesses had led me to imagine that their perdition was inevitable. But you, Father, inform me that these same excesses secure their salvation. I mean, the way you can see Voltaire says, hey, I love this. I want this myself. Blessings on you, my good Father, for this way of justifying people, Others prescribe painful austerities for the healing of the soul. But you show that souls that which may be thought desperately distempered are in quite good health. What an excellent device for being happy, both in this world and in the next. I had always supposed that the less a man thought of God, the more he sinned. But from what I see now, if one could only succeed in bringing himself not to think of God at all, then everything would be pure to him at the time coming. Away with these, with your half-half sinners that retain some sneaking affection for virtue. They will be damned, every one of them, those semi-sinners. But commend me to your errant sinners, hardened, unalloyed, out-and-out, thoroughbred sinners. Hell hath no place for them. They have cheated the devil purely by virtue of their devotion to his service. He goes, oh, this is, that's the wit of Pascal. Isn't that priceless? And he's really pulling this guy's leg. And at the end, the guy says, at the end of this part, he says, well, I'm going to have to go check another book on that. Well, I have it. He says, I'll have an answer for you next. Well, that's just one of the provincial letters. And you can see why Voltaire, all the people who read these, they fell in love with Pascal, not even know who he was, because of the provincial letters. Of course, he's making fun, but he actually has a serious point, too. He's very concerned to make the case for grace and the fact that the grace of the Augustinian view of grace. And I'm happy to say the Jesuits come out not smelling very good here in the Pascal Pensée, because he does not like the Jesuits. But then later on, the Holy See, the Vatican, did not excommunicate the Jansenists. So that's good news. So anyway, after he wrote these letters, 1657, and of course only a few years later he died in 1662, but he was also working on trying to make the case for Christian faith and doing it with thoughts. And it seems to me, in his case for Christian faith, Pascal basically expresses his goal in two great quotes. And I'll read the two great quotes and then show you, and with several other wonderful readings from the Pensées, how he makes those arguments. The first argument he makes very early on in he titled some general chapter titles. And the general chapter title for this part that I'm going to read now is called The Necessity of the Wager. He has a whole, of course, and I'll tell you the wager in just a minute, because he's very famous for the famous Pascal wager. But in the beginning of that chapter, he has a wonderful quote, and this quote gives you the first clue as to his strategy for trying to make the case for Christian faith that he was gradually accumulating all these thoughts to try to make. First, he says, men despise religion. He means here Christian faith. They hate it. They fear it's true. To remedy this, we must begin by showing that Christian faith is not contrary to reason. Now, that's going to be a major thing I'm going to have to point out. Pascal is not anti-intellectual. He is very concerned. He is a scientist. He's a superb mathematician, and he's going to try to make the case that the Christian faith is not contrary to reason. It makes sense. Now, it is intriguing to me that if you were in my lectures on C.S. Lewis, you know that is also a very major part of Lewis's approach in the book Miracles. And Lewis is very concerned to show that the gospel makes sense. It pulls things together. It integrates. It's not chaotic. It's not anti-intellectual, okay? But now that's Pascal too. So he says we must show that it is not contrary to reason. And secondly, we must show it's venerable. By venerable, he means that if you were to believe it, it would have a good effect, not a bad effect. Again, that ties to reason. It would. Remember, Lewis has that wonderful parable he tells about, let's suppose we have parts of a symphony, and somebody says, this is the part that will hold the whole symphony together and make all the parts come together. Our job is to test to see if it does do that. In other words, that is actually to test the reason of it. Does it make sense? So Pascal is putting his weight down on the same point. We must show that it's venerable. That means if I were to believe in it, would it have a good effect or a bad effect? And we must do this to inspire respect for it. See, Pascal wants us to respect the gospel because it's true, and I mean because it's venerable. Then we must show that at its center is love. That it's lovable. That it's at its core is love. And I love his line here. In order to make good men and women, hope is true. That's a very intriguing point. That's the moral argument. That I should be able to see the love of God so that I am, you know, Martin Luther has that great line, if men are converted because of fear, they will later hate their conversion. And Pascal does not want anybody converted because of fear. He wants them converted because they've experienced the love of God. That becomes so beautiful when we get to some of the most beautiful of the thoughts that he has. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to tell you that just before he wrote the Provincial Letters, he had what he called his second conversion. And that's where he was on a carriage that almost went into the River Seine and was caught on the edge, and he almost died. And that's when he had his great second conversion. So he always talks about two conversions he had. The first one, when he had that first accident, age 19, and the second one, just before he started to write the Provincial Letters. So we must show them that there's love at its center to make good men and women hope that it's true. And then finally, we must show that it's true. So he does care about truth, but truth in a large sense. Then I'll give you one more quote where he repeats this again, but does it in a little different set of language. He says, there are three sources, and this is in the chapter he titled The Means of Belief. There are three sources of faith, belief. Reason, custom, by that he means tradition, that's the venerable part, tradition, and inspiration. The Christian faith, which alone has reason, he believes is reasonable, does not acknowledge as her true children those who believe without inspiration. For him, there has to be that mystery. There has to be the mystery of confirmation. Remember the Bart line, the Holy Spirit's ministry happens when I'm able to say this great truth is also for me. And when I'm able to say it's also for me, something mysterious has happened. It's not just a general truth, but it's also for me. And so Pascal also agrees with that. So he says, Christian faith, which alone has reason, does not acknowledge as her true children those who believe without inspiration. It is not that she excludes reason and tradition, custom. On the contrary, the mind must be open to proofs. There's where now the truth teaching, the making sense comes in. Must be confirmed by custom, tradition, venerability. When I watch and see what happens in people's lives who do truly believe, do I see good things happening or bad things happening? Okay. In their character. Maybe not. They may still have disasters. After all, look at this man. He had a stroke. He had everything go wrong with him you could have. And yet, so he says, the mind must be open to proofs. It must be confirmed by tradition, custom. And it must offer itself in humbleness to inspiration, which alone can produce a true and saving effect. And then in Latin, he put this famous line, no escaping the cross of Christ. You can't escape the fact that Christ himself has to be the one who does the proving. Okay, I think those two quotes are probably the most fundamental quotes in explaining Pascal's strategy, his case for Christianity strategy. All right, he's going to move in three directions then. The first, he's going to try to make the case that the gospel makes sense. It's not anti-intellectual. It's not anti-scientific. It makes sense. And then, now here's where he takes you by surprise. After he does that, he's going to say, well, since it makes sense, then everybody should automatically believe. But they don't. Because man, woman is very complicated. And Pascal is often called the father of existentialism because he saw that the existence issues get in our way. And that's why Kierkegaard and people like that just love Pascal. Because he saw this. We're very complicated. And here's the most famous of all Pascal lines is concerning that complicatedness. The heart has its reason that reason cannot know. A lot of people have used that to describe falling in love with a girl or falling in love with a guy. And I carved that on driftwood too. I have that. The heart has its reason that reason cannot know. Because we're complicated. We're not logical. Now that will bring you to the great the wager, which I'll tell you in just a moment. And third, so he's going to go into that. He's going to show how complicated we are. And that'll be all his great thoughts on man's misery. And then finally, he's going to make the case that God, therefore, must make his own case. He must, and that's inspiration, see, he must break through. And that's the sort of great evangelical breakthrough and core of Pascal's insight. Okay, first, the gospel makes sense. He really has some wonderful things to say about how the gospel does make sense. I'll just give you an example. This will take your breath away. If you're a scientist, every scientist that's ever read this is totally amazed. And scientists, by the way, love Pascal. Whether they're Christians or not, they love Pascal. He is now helping us to understand this amazing world in which we're a part of, to get us ready for the wager, to get us ready for the fact that it makes sense. He said, let man... Okay, let me see if I can find a good place to start. Okay. He'll say, let man contemplate the whole of nature in her full and grand majesty. Mind you, he's writing this in the 17th century. And turn his vision from the low objects which surround him. Let him gaze into that brilliant light set like an eternal lamp to illuminate the universe. Let the earth appear to him a point in comparison with the vast circle described by the sun. And let him wonder at the fact that this vast circle is itself but a very fine point in comparison with that described by the stars in their revolution around in the firmament. But if our view is arrested there, let our imagination pass beyond. It will sooner exhaust. He's already billions of miles out before any Hubble telescope knew about being billions of miles out. And he's saying this in the 17th century, when most people never dreamed of the immensity of space. And he's dreaming about it. By the way, Einstein loved Pascal too, because Einstein, you know, did most of his theoretical physics by thinking about it first before he did experiments. He just thought. And so that's what Pascal's doing. The whole visible world is only an imperceptible atom now in the ample bosom of nature. No idea approaches it. We may enlarge our conceptions beyond all imaginable space. We only produce atoms in comparison with the reality of things. It's an infinite sphere, the center of which is everywhere. The circumference, nowhere. In short, it is the greatest sensible mark of the almighty power of God that imagination loses itself in this thought. He's got this sense of vastness of space. Now, returning to himself, let man consider what he is in comparison with all existence. Let him regard himself as lost in this remote corner of nature, and from the little cell in which he finds himself lodged. I mean the universe. He calls the universe a cell. Let him estimate at their true value the earth, the kingdoms, the cities, and himself. What is man in the infinite? Now we're so tiny. He says, but I want to show him another prodigy, equally astonishing. Let him examine the most delicate thing he knows. Let a mite be given to him, with its minute body and parts incomparably more minute, limbs with their joints, veins in the limbs, blood in the veins, humors in the blood, drops in the humors, vapors in the drops. This is before microscopic science was figuring all this out. Dividing these last things again, let him exhaust his powers of conception, and let the last object at which he can arrive at now be that point of our discourse. Perhaps he will think that here is the smallest point in nature, but I will let him see therein a new abyss. This is nuclear physics, folks, before anybody could look into an atom. I will paint for him not only the visible universe, but all that he can conceive of nature's immensity in the womb of this abridged atom. Let him see therein an infinity of universes, each which has its own firmament, its planets, its earth. He saw electrons going around. In the same proportion as in the visible world, and in each animal, in each last mite, which he'll see himself again, finding still in others, and da 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 da, it goes on and on. For in fact, what is man in nature? A nothing in comparison with the infinite, and an all in comparison with the nothing. A mean between nothing and everything, since he is infinitely removed from comprehending the extremes. The end of things and their beginnings are hopelessly hidden from him. It's an impenetrable secret. He's equally incapable of seeing the nothing from which he was made and the infinite in which he is swallowed up. He's in a point right in between. He saw man that way, in this point. And so anyway, it's just amazing that he had this kind of amazing sense of nuclear physics and also the sense of astronomy. And so that's why astronomers love Pascal, as do microbiologists. And so he has another fascinating quote, which is a mathematical one, to show the reasonableness and the fact of how God could be infinite, and how God could be in time too. He says, "Do you believe it's impossible that God is infinite? Yes, I wish therefore to show you an infinite and invisible thing." This is to show how God can be particular and yet also infinite. And here's his mathematical parable. It still blows your mind away. I'll show you something that is, one, concrete, particular, and infinite at the same time. It's almost like Einsteinian general theory of relativity now. I'm going to show it to you, he says. Here it is. It's a point moving everywhere with an infinite velocity. It's at a point, and it's everywhere. That's how Pascal saw God being everywhere and at one point. So he said it's not against reason that God could know you, and God be here, and be everywhere. I'll show it to you mathematically. A point. Got it? Okay. Now it's moving in every direction at an infinite velocity. That's Pascal. Wow. So he said it's incomprehensible that God should exist, and it's incomprehensible that he should not exist. So then he says, if you're using just pure common sense then, and reason, then you simply would have to agree, you would have to agree in the existence of God. And in fact, he said, if you don't agree with the existence of God, then you are not really, you're not being reasonable. And then comes his most famous argument, the argument of the grand wager. He says, as a matter of fact, if you're being totally reasonable and you're trying to think of what's infinite and what's finite, and that's all we have to work with, is finite, infinite. He's just showing you there's a possibility of infinite, the point going in at an extreme velocity, at infinite velocity in every direction. So he said, if you have those two things to work with, what's infinite and what's finite, he said, so if God is infinite and we're finite, because we're in this disproportion in between what is everywhere, and we're in between. He said, now, therefore, we only have choices to make, which we can choose either toward what's infinite or towards finite. So he said, if I were to wager, here's the wager, if I were to wager against God, now follow the wager, it's very simple. If I were to wager against God, that means I'm going to say there is no God, and there is no God, then I have made a, from a finite standpoint, because I'm finite, I've made a finite decision that is a finite advantage for me. Because I haven't wasted my time in these 60 years I have to live, or 70 years I have to live. I haven't wasted my time worshiping God and doing all that. So I have a finite gain, And, of course, if there is no God, I have a finite loss. Because, I mean, I haven't lost much. It's just that I've lost the chance of being in church for these 75 years, which may not be that big a loss. Okay. So I said, so if I wager against God and there is no God, I have a finite gain and only a finite loss. Now, if I wager against God and there is a God, then I have an... Since I wagered against him, I still don't have any... as far as the finite is concerned, since God is now infinite, not finite, then I have an infinite loss instead of a finite loss. So I lose more. Okay, now if I wager for God and there is no God, I have a finite loss because I've wasted my time. And... but if I wager for God and there is a God, I have an infinite gain. So he says, if you're reasonable, you would choose for the infinite gain over the finite loss. See, the best you get by wagering against God is a finite gain. The worst is an infinite loss. The worst you get by betting on God is a finite loss. But that's no big deal. You just wasted some years in church. But if you wager for him and there is a God, you have the possibility of an infinite gain. So he said, if you were reasonable, you would always wager for God. Then why don't we? Now that brings us to the second part of his complex argument. Because the heart has its reason that reason cannot know. We're complicated. We are too complicated. And we don't make our decisions on the basis of reason. We make our decisions for other reasons. And so then he has a great number of chapters and thoughts that he devotes to the fact that, well, then we end up in a kind of miserable situation because we decide to wager. We are confused. And so I'll read you one of the most famous in this section when he talks about man's misery apart from God and the lostness that we feel. he puts it this way first. Having now not chosen God and not chosen to worship God in our confusion. So this is our true state. This is what makes us incapable of certain knowledge or of absolute ignorance. We sail within a vast sphere ever drifting in uncertainty, driven from end to end. And when we think to attach ourselves to any point, to fasten to it, it wavers, it leaves us. And if we follow it, it eludes our grasp. It slips past us and it vanishes forever. Nothing stays for us. This is our natural condition, and yet it's contrary to our inclination. We would like something to stay. We would like to find something that we can hold on to. But what happens is, since we have now decided not to ally ourselves with God, who is the source of truth, and we've decided not to do that in our confusion, in our complicated nature, then now we really find ourselves going adrift in every direction, and our whole groundwork cracks, and the earth opens up to us in abyss. And then he has, of course, a very famous section where he talks about the fact that we have this lostness that we begin to feel, and it's where he has another one of his famous lines. So here's man now. In vain, we try to fill all of his surroundings. We seek things to help us to not obtain in things present. And all these things are inadequate. We try to, in other words, this is his great diversion argument. We begin then just to try to stuff into our lives because nothing is staying put for us. So we try to stuff in our lives things that will give us meaning. But these are all inadequate because of the infinite abyss that we have that can only be filled by the infinite. And that is to say, only by God himself. That's the famous God-sized vacuum. Some people have talked about Pascal's God-sized vacuum. He says we have this infinite abyss. We need God to anchor our lives. And when we don't have God, and we've chosen not to wager on Him, and we don't have God as the source of the truth, then we find ourselves adrift, and we find ourselves stuffing everything we can find into that abyss, and it doesn't work. And so we're desperately trying to make sense out of our lives by putting everything else into our lives. And so we end up miserable. One of the, again, some of the famous lines that he has on our misery: the greatness of man is great in that he knows himself to be miserable. A tree does not know itself to be miserable. It's then being miserable to know one is miserable, but to know it is to be great. And then he has this other famous line: a house in ruins is not miserable. Only man is miserable. So now he has all these thoughts on the fact that we are miserable in this. We have this sense that we're not able to find anything that we can hold on to. We stuff everything, like the king has to have a jester. He has some funny lines on that. The king has to have a jester because he says, I put it down that a man cannot spend 1 hour in a room alone by himself, because then he gets ennui. And that's one of his famous lines, ennui, and he feels his nothingness. And so he has to have diversions to put into that room. And that's why the king has jesters, and that's why people go to war, is they have to have something to occupy them, because they haven't got this eternal truth to hold on to. That's the God-sized vacuum. So we put everything else into that vacuum to try to fill it, and it doesn't work. And so man is miserable. And he has all these famous quotations on the misery of man. And probably the most famous and one of the very best of all is this one, in which I love, because it pays us a compliment, and yet it shows our misery. Man is but a reed, this is a famous line, the most feeble thing in nature, but he's the thinking reed. The entire universe need not arm itself to crush him. A vapor, a drop of water, suffices to kill him. But if the universe were to crush him, man would still be more noble than that which killed him, because he knows that he's dying, and the universe knows not of that. We're the thinking reed. That's his great misery argument. We know we're in misery. We know that we can't, we're trying, like the king with a jester, we're trying to keep ourselves from thinking about being in the room alone by ourselves, because we know we can't stay there a whole hour by ourselves. So we're unable to do that. We're unable to find meaning, and we're stuffing everything into our lives to give us meaning. And so there's that sense of misery, and yet we're the thinking reed. We know we're miserable. A house in ruins does not know it's miserable. Man does. So to know your misery is to be miserable. To know it is to be great. So that's one of the famous Pascal quotes. Well, then what's the answer? We come to the third part. And the third part is that God must prove himself. God must break through. And he does it in ways that take us by surprise. And that is really wonderful, that how God breaks through and takes us by surprise. Okay, some of the famous quotes that are in this regard, I think, are wonderful. He has this wonderful line too. He says, it's dangerous to make man see how clearly he resembles the apes and not also show him his greatness. It's dangerous to make him see his greatness too clearly apart from seeing how much he resembles the apes. So he's very, very good on that too. But finding man, with all of this ennui, finally begins to burn out. And then he has this very famous line: it's good to be weary and worn out in the vain pursuit of that which can give meaning to my life, so that I may open my arms to the Redeemer. That's his famous quote: to open my arms to the Redeemer. And what do I find when I open my arms to the Redeemer? Let me read the wonderful things he says there. When I open my arms to the Redeemer, what happens? He says that he was this way: so I hold out my arms to my Redeemer, who, having been foretold for 4,000 years, has come to suffer and to die for me on earth. at the time and under all circumstances foretold. Notice, now he's going to focus on the grace that we discover from Christ. By his grace, surprise gift love, I await death in peace in the hope of being eternally united with him. And I live with joy. And he bestows on me his love, in which then I live with joy. So he talks about the fact that Jesus Christ is the one who gives that to me. And here's the beautiful way he puts it. He says, an artisan is able to speak about wealth. And a lawyer may speak about war or about royalty. But, you know, artisan means a peasant. A peasant may speak about wealth. And a lawyer may talk about war or talk about any other subject like royalty. But a rich man is one who can rightly speak about wealth. And a king can indifferently speak about a great gift which he has just made. And here's one of my favorite lines from Pascal. And God can speak about God. That's a great line. Only God can speak about himself. He has to make himself known. He has to make his own self known to us. And then has this wonderful line. Who has taught the evangelist the qualities of a perfectly heroic soul? They paint it so perfectly in Jesus Christ. Why do they make him weak in his agony? Do they not know how to paint a resolute death? Yes, for the same St. Luke paints the death of St. Stephen as braver than that of Jesus Christ. You ever thought about that? Stephen's death is more brave than Jesus. Jesus is crying out, God, can this cup pass from me? They make him therefore capable of fear before the necessity of dying has come, and then altogether brave. But when they make him so troubled, it is when he afflicts himself, and when men afflict him, he is altogether strong. This wonderful quotation about Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ said great things so simply that it seems as though he had not thought of them, and yet so clearly that we easily see what he thought of them. This clearness joined to this simplicity is wonderful. And then again, it is absurd to take offense at the lowliness of Jesus Christ, as if his lowliness were in the same order of greatness which he came to manifest. If we consider this greatness in his life, in his passion, in his obscurity, in his death, in his choice of his disciples, in their desertion, and in his secret resurrection, and the rest we shall see is so immense that we shall have no reason for being offended at his lowliness. He saw that. He saw the fact that our Lord's grace is shown in his humiliation at the cross. He's the one that, when we open our arms to the Redeemer, he's the one that comes. What do the prophets say of Jesus Christ? That he'll be clearly God? No, but that he'll be God truly hidden. That he'll be slighted. That none will think of who he is. That he'll be a stone of stumbling upon which many will stumble. Let people then reproach us no longer for want of clearness, since we make profession of it. Jesus Christ, in other words, comes as the hidden one who fulfills fulfills his grace for us. And so there you have his threefold approach. It makes sense to man, as complicated as man is. How does it make sense finally? God himself proves himself. And so I come back again to his original statement that we started with at the very beginning of his whole argument in page 64. He says, we despise religion. We despise Christianity. We fear it's true. To remedy this, we must show that Christian faith is not contrary to reason, that it is venerable, to inspire respect for it. Then we must show that love is at its center to make good men and women hope it's true. And finally, we must show that it's true. And that's what he tried to do. Hey, that's Pascal.